content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first article today is entitled Micah Lasher, Child Magician, written by Joel Stein. I'm meeting with Micah Lasher at a diner on the Upper West Side. The last time I saw him was also at an Upper West Side diner. That was 32 years ago. He was 12. I was 22. He was interviewing me for a job. Lasher is running for Congress in the June 23rd Democratic primary for the smallest, richest, most educated district in the country, the one that Gerald Nadler is leaving after 34 years. New York's 12th district jaggedly stretches all the way across Manhattan from the top of Central Park down to 12th Street. It is so liberal that whoever wins the primary will likely get to keep the seat as long as they want. It's so rich that whoever wins will have considerable power in Congress, thanks to Manhattanites' ability to donate to other campaigns. In his Yankees jacket over a white button-down, Lasher doesn't look that different from the last time I saw him, which is strange because he has since undergone puberty. He still has a boyish, earnest, Michael Cera energy. He has three kids and is married to a finance executive now, but he still lives in a building with his mom. When the waitress comes over, Lasher politely orders cottage cheese, strawberries, blueberries, two eggs sunny side up, and an orange juice. The orange juice, so high in sugar, seems suspiciously wild. Lasher has spent his entire life in Manhattan, except for a semester at NYU spent in London, where he roomed with the comedian Aziz Ansari. He's also spent his entire career in politics. At 15, while he was at Stuyvesant High School, he worked on a state assembly member's campaign for Manhattan Borough President. At 20, he helped start a successful political consulting firm, SKDK. This led to policy jobs with Nadler, Mayor Michael Bloomberg, and Governor Kathy Hochul, and to his current gig in the assembly. But I worked for Lasher long before he turned 15. I now live 3,000 miles away and don't have any stake in this race, but it's one of the most interesting primary fields in the country. Though Lasher is a party insider pick, having landed endorsements from Nadler and Bloomberg, who has offered to donate up to $5 million to support him, he's not the most exciting candidate. He's running against George Conway, the former Republican, former husband of Kellyanne Conway, and former resident of a home without a green screen in every room. The candidate leading in early polls is Jack Schlossberg, the 33-year-old grandson of John F. Kennedy, who spoke at the 2020 Democratic National Convention and has 1.7 million social media followers eager to watch him simultaneously walk and talk smack about his cousin Robert F. Kennedy Jr., surf shirtless, or laugh after someone calls him, "You incel Frankenstein-looking motherfucker." Lasher is somehow less exciting, even, than Alex Bors, another state assembly member vying for the seat, who once worked as a Palantir data scientist and now takes on AI companies. People mostly see Lasher as an earnest, wonky, slow-talking, detail-oriented policy guy. But they don't know the Micah Lasher I knew. In 1994, I was a year out of college and working as a fact-checker at Reader's Digest Books. Not Reader's Digest the magazine, where all the action was, but Reader's Digest Books. One of the older fact-checkers told me about a freelance job that paid $20 an hour, $2 more than I was making. His friend's son was a magician. He had gotten a book deal and needed a research assistant. It was soul-crushing to learn that a 12-year-old already had accomplished my dream of writing a book. Even worse, he had accomplished my far bigger dream of being a guest on David Letterman's show. I met Lasher and his father, who had been an amateur magician, at a diner on the Upper West Side. His dad did most of the talking, explaining how slammed Lasher was with school, birthday party performances, and his upcoming bar mitzvah. Then he got the kid to do some magic tricks for me. They were astounding. I clenched coins in my fist that seeped into the ether. Cards sitting on the table in front of me changed faces. If he had done this for me at any other time in human history, I would have burned him at the stake, mostly for being Jewish, but also for the freaky devil magic. My friend D.A. Wallace, the former lead singer of Chester French, turned biotech investor, went to magic camp with Lasher. Back then, Tannen's magic camp was held on Long Island, and Lasher was the greatest of all time, Wallach told me. He was better at close-up magic than most of the adults. He was the equivalent of Usain Bolt at that age. He could have been a super successful magician with a show in Vegas, which seems more fun than Congress. Still, Wallach understands why Lasher doesn't talk about his childhood fame much. There's something shameful about magic. It's corny, he said. When I was working on Lasher's book, my friend Jonathan would help me several times a week, claiming to be the amazing Micah, and, with a lisp, due to an imaginary retainer that Lasher probably wouldn't have for several years, said, "Mither Theron, this work is unacceptable," which wasn't all that far off, not long after Lasher fired me. The idea that I'd help dig up interesting tidbits from the history of magic, but I couldn't not distinguish between a tidbit and a basic piece of magic history. Lasher's dad had to call and tell me that my services were no longer required. The magic of Micah Lasher, more than 50 tricks that will amaze and delight everyone, including you, came out in 1996 and was a hit, but I didn't know about it until a few years ago when I bought a copy. I immediately turned to the acknowledgments. I did not think I would be listed there, but if I were, I expected it to read, "I want to thank Joel Stein for teaching me the magic trick where you steal $1,000 from a small boy." Instead, he doled out the elegant graciousness that one learns from writing stacks of bar mitzvah thank you cards. Joel's research was his first real trip into the world of magic, and he did a really great job. Lasher stopped doing magic shortly after he wrote the book. As he eats his cottage cheese, he tells me why. Magic became very much a part of my identification, and it could crowd out other things. Instead, he became the editor of the Stuyvesant High School newspaper, where he had a fight with the administration over censorship that was covered in the New York Times. Magic had been a bond between him and his father, and Lasher wanted to be his own person. His dad mentored others through the Society of Young Magicians, and when he died in 2020, Lasher inherited his huge library of magic books, which I probably should have looked at for research for this book, his book. Most people go into politics seeking fame, but Lasher had walked away from it. Speaking at rallies and press conferences is part of the job he likes the least, and the part he's worst at. Even at the height of his magic career, he was famous for close-up magic, not for putting on a David Copperfield show. Schlossberg and Conway, Lasher tells me, promote themselves as politicians who, quote, "know how to function in this low-attention economy," end quote. But Lasher isn't sure that anybody's being persuaded in this low-attention economy. We're generating a lot of content. We're getting clicks, but I don't know that we're really moving people that much. The work of change is still work, and it requires relentless persistence. That's the case I'm making to voters. Lasher says he learned some lessons about politics from magic. He's contemplated writing an essay about it, but feared outing himself as a weird child magician. Also, it lends itself to all these obvious jokes about politics and trickery, he says. But if he did write it, this is what he would say. Great magicians start with a goal and work backwards. There is a way that I could walk into this diner, talk to you for 30 minutes, and make myself disappear. It's simply a function of figuring out the mechanics. In policymaking, I found that one of the great impediments to change-making is there's a ton of self-limitation, risk aversion, and lack of imagination. Spending years as a kid looking at things that were impossible with the presumption that there was a way to do it was a pretty good discipline for policy making. Lasher hasn't done magic for anyone but his uninterested children for a long time. But when I bring out a deck of cards, he nods. For 15 minutes, he does magic inches from me, that cocky-faced kid, the one that says, "Yeah, that happened," returning at the end of each trick. The card tricks are amazing, although, I have to admit, less impressive than they'd seemed when he was a prepubescent boy. He does two of them and then says he'll do just one more, and then just one more. I select a card out of the deck, memorize it, and put it back. He does that magician thing where he pretends to show me my card, and I have to tell him that, no, it was actually the Ten of Hearts, and he has to act flummoxed. "Oh, the Ten of Hearts," Lasher says. "That's the one I put under the orange juice." There it is, face down under the glass of juice, the one he barely drank. And now he has to leave for his next meeting, at a diner, 10 blocks away. Next, the only thing worse than Spirit Airlines is a world without Spirit Airlines. Written by Sahil Desai. Spirit Airlines died as it lived. Lots of angry customers and no one picking up the phone. Early yesterday morning, when America's most hated airline announced that it would immediately cease all operations, Spirit left tens of thousands of passengers at airports across America, scrambling to figure out what to do next. Some arrived to catch their flight, only to find deserted check-in kiosks plastered with a goodbye message. All Spirit flights have been canceled, and customer service is no longer available. The end of Spirit was sudden and dramatic, but not unexpected. The budget airline had long been going through it, one failed merger after the next, two bankruptcies within the span of a year, and finally, rising fuel costs from the Iran war that turned a bad situation into a dire one. When the hope of a last-minute Trump administration bailout fell through, Spirit Airlines apparently had no choice but to ground its banana yellow planes for good. The Schadenfreude that Spirit's many haters are feeling now is free, unlike everything else Spirit ever offered. The airline lured customers with dirt-cheap fares and then nickeled and dimed them with hidden extra charges. Wanted to book online? That came with a passenger usage fee of up to $28 each way. A carry-on bag? That was $33 or more if you waited until the last minute. Or how about a printed boarding pass? Another $10 a pop if you asked an airport agent. Even the water came with a price tag, $4.50. And that was before the indignity of cramped seats, frequent delays, and unreliable customer service. People have dubbed Spirit the, quote, school bus of the sky, end quote, and the, quote, airline equivalent of gas station sushi, end quote. In one 2014 poll, respondents said that they would prefer sitting near snakes on a plane, actual reptiles, not the movie, over flying Spirit. For all the justified kvetching, America is about to learn a hard lesson. The only thing worse than a world without Spirit, with Spirit, is a one without it. The Spirit haters are going to eat their words, Kathy Nestoro, a travel agent at Going, a flight discount site, told me. The airline ran on a singular cynical insight. In exchange for low airfare, plenty of travelers would be willing to tolerate essentially anything. When one passenger emailed Spirit in 2007 to complain, Ben Baldassano, then the company's CEO, accidentally replied, "All," and gave up the game. "Let him tell the world how bad we are," he wrote. "He's never flown before with us anyway, and we'll be back when we save him a penny." And Baldassano was right. Even factoring in all the add-in fees, Spirit reliably was among the most affordable options, especially if you needed a last-minute ticket. Spirit was going to offer you the cheapest option 9 times out of 10, Nastro said. "I owe some credit for my marriage to a $58.19 Spirit flight. In 2017, I had just started dating my now wife when she moved halfway across the country, and a flight I booked on a whim kept us together. My flight was delayed, and the seat was roughly as cushy as a park bench, but the price was right, and now I have a life partner." In other words, Spirit was the airline of the masses, the kind of people who pack their own sandwiches instead of paying $21 for a turkey wrap at Hudson News. Because Spirit was so focused on budget travelers, the airline operated in many smaller cities that otherwise had few other options, and it was the only airline that offered nonstop flights on certain routes. Even if you swore off Spirit, and plenty of people did, you have certainly benefited from the airline. Spirit paved the way for other ultra-cheap airlines, and the entire industry has had to slash prices to keep up. Consider what happened when Spirit started flying from Houston to Kansas City in 2014. The airline launched its route at $150, more than half the average price offered by the sole carrier at the time, United. Within months, United had sliced its fare down to $180, and Spirit had dipped down to $90. The same phenomenon happened so many times and in so many places that it now has a name, the Spirit Effect. According to one study, in markets ultra-cheap airlines such as Spirit and Frontier, airfare is 21% lower on average compared with markets without them. In response to the airline's success, most airlines now have their own basic economy fares that needle you to pay extra for baggage, seat selection, and so much else. None of that is going away now that Spirit is no longer around. Instead, everyone is going to be stuck paying more for less. Without the competition from Spirit, airlines will have one fewer reason to keep prices down. One analysis found that airfares rose by an average of 14% for routes that Spirit left between 2024 and 2025. And 2026 is already turning out to be the most expensive summer travel season in years. "This is the worst time for the worst possible outcome," Nastro said. The paradox of Spirit is this: it was a horrible airline to fly, but it also allowed more people to fly than ever before. When you're forced to squeeze inside of a middle seat in row 27, it's not hard to feel nostalgic about a time when flying was glamorous and comfortable. In the 1950s, Pan Am passengers in coach were served stuffed guinea hen. Flying round trip from Los Angeles to New York cost $208 in 1958. In today's dollars, that's $2,377. Since just 1995, average airfare in the U.S. decreased by 41%. Now cheap flights are becoming harder and harder to come by. Spirit is gone, and other budget airlines, JetBlue and Frontier, are also struggling. Soon, the $4.50 water bottle will look like the real golden age of travel. Today's third story, "The Era of Rational Discourse is Over," written by Adam Kirsch. Americans have a long history of being hurried into war on false pretexts. The yellow press encouraged a war fever in 1898 by blaming the sinking of the USS Maine on the Spanish, even though the Navy's own expert said it was caused by an accidental explosion. The George W. Bush administration justified the invasion of Iraq by claiming that Saddam Hussein had connections to the 9/11 attacks and was building weapons of mass destruction, neither of which turned out to be true. But with the Iran war, as with so many other ways, Donald Trump has broken new ground. He is the first president to start a war without even bothering to lie to the public, because he simply didn't care what the public thought. The American people weren't consulted about attacking Iran, neither formally through their elected representatives in Congress, nor informally by allowing pundits, activists, and civil society groups to have their say. As Trump told the New York Times in January, his power as commander-in-chief was constrained by nothing but my own morality, my own mind. It's the only thing that can stop me. The German philosopher Jürgen Habermas, a prolific commentator on world events, didn't live to comment on the Iran war. He died on March 14th at age 96, 2 weeks after American and Israeli airstrikes began. But it bore out his worst fears about the fate of liberal democracy, for which he spent a long lifetime analyzing and defending. For Habermas, the essence of democracy was discourse, back-and-forth argument about ideas and values. In his landmark works of political and social theory, he wrote about the public sphere where citizens come together to hammer out judgments, and about communicative action, which turns language into a force for cooperation. All political power derives from the communicative power of citizens, he wrote, and in an ideal democracy, all relevant questions, issues, and contributions are brought up and processed in discourses and negotiations. Habermas began his career in West Germany in the 1950s when ex-Nazis still dominated the academic establishment. Turning against the influence of Martin Heidegger, then the idol of German philosophy, despite his collaboration with the Nazi regime, the young Habermas found a mentor in Theodor Adorno, a radical social critic who spent the Nazi period in exile. Adorno was one of the co-founders of the Frankfurt School of Critical Theory, and Habermas took up his mantle as the leader of the school's second generation, spending most of his career at the University of Frankfurt. But whereas Adorno effectively lost hope for modern civilization after the Holocaust, Habermas devoted his career to finding resources for freedom in the Western intellectual tradition. That quest began with his first book, The Structural Transformation of the Public Sphere, published in 1962. It is still his most popular work, largely because it is more concrete and historical than his latter, densely theoretical writing. Habermas traced the birth of the modern concept of public opinion to the coffee houses, salons, and newspapers of 18th century Europe, which gave ordinary people the opportunity to debate current events and pass judgment on the decisions of monarchs. This milieu, which laid the groundwork for the French Revolution, served as Habermas's political inspiration. The public sphere, he wrote, meant the dissolution of domination, so that ideas and policies prevailed on no other ground than the compelling insight of a public opinion. But Habermas recognized that the liberal democratic ideal was never fully realized, not in the 18th century, when the public sphere was open only to men of property, and not in the 20th, when public opinion had become passive and inert, an object to be manipulated by propaganda. The world fashioned by mass media, he lamented, is a public sphere in appearance only. The legitimacy of law, he wrote in his 1992 book Between Facts and Norms, ultimately depends on a communicative arrangement. Citizens must be participants in rational discourses, able to speak their minds freely and to find mutually agreeable solutions to difficult problems. His study of the dynamics of discourse took Habermas beyond the realm of political philosophy. His scholarship draws on sociology, linguistics, psychology, and cultural studies. engaging with a wide range of other thinkers, past and present. Indeed, Habermas sometimes gives the impression of having read everything about everything. His prose is equally forbidding, dense and abstract in the long tradition of German philosophy. Yet his work can also be seen as an example of what he called discourse ethics in action, an earnest back-and-forth engagement with other minds. In real life, of course, we don't use language only for rational persuasion. We also use it to give orders and make threats, demanding obedience instead of agreement. But when we agree with someone because of the potential losses or rewards, Habermas argued, we aren't truly agreeing, just giving in. By the same principle, public discourse is authentic only when no participant is excluded, no opinion is forbidden, and no one is subjected to coercion. These conditions are seldom found in real politics, but we always get closer to the ideal, can always get closer to the ideal or further from it. Since the media agenda is set by the rich and powerful, it's nearly impossible for dissenting voices to get a hearing. By the end of Habermas's life, ironically, the advance of technology had created exactly the opposite problem. Thanks to the internet and social media, the barrier to entering a marketplace of ideas has never been lower. A lone streamer can become an authority to millions, while once mighty TV networks and newspapers struggle to stay afloat. This ought to be a boon for communication, and in the early days of the internet, many idealists thought it would be. So why was the glut of discourse turned out, has the glut of discourse turned out to be worse for democracy than scarcity was? The problem isn't just that people deliberately lie, spreading disinformation for personal or political gain. It's that the public sphere has shattered into competing publics, each able to ignore the others. The point of deliberative politics is, after all, that it enables us to improve our beliefs in political disputes and get closer to correct solutions to problems, Habermas wrote. He was in his 90s when he wrote about social media, and if anything, he underestimated the challenge it poses, not just to liberal democracy, but to his own thought and worldview. The most sinister effect of the internet on today's politics isn't just that it foments division. It's that the weightlessness of online existence breeds a kind of gleeful nihilism. Habermas was right to call Trump autocratic, but what makes him a strong man for the social media age is his maddening frivolity, the way he doesn't seem to know or care what he's doing or what he will do next. When cruelty and carelessness can be such a politically effective combination, it's clear that the era of rational discourse, the era of Jürgen Habermas, is well and truly over. That last article was edited because we've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Please be sure to join us the next time. We hope you've enjoyed listening. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.